sales win rates have plummeted to a mere 17%, and outdated technology and tedious manual processes are to blame. Meanwhile, managers lack the visibility they need to hold their teams accountable. But imagine a world in which these crippling issues are solved automatically. Revenue.io automates the most frustrating parts of sales so reps can focus on what they do best, selling. Completely automate pre-call research, logging conversation data in your CRM, writing post-conversation recap emails, and prioritized outreach. And as reps book more meetings and close more deals, managers gain the real-time insight they need to scale what's working across their entire team. Ready to say goodbye to tedious sales processes and watch your win rate soar? Head over to revenue.io to learn more.
It's also fear-based as well, right? Because oftentimes the managers, they don't necessarily have the resources to say, well, before you can do more, you got to learn how to do better. And then once you learn how to do better, you can do more better. But
yeah, exactly. I agree. And I think the formula that I've learned for productivity is effectiveness times efficiency. So if you're being effective and you're doing all the right things, then, of course, you'll improve performance if you also increase efficiency. But if you're multiplying by zero or 0.1, you can run very fast without actually getting anywhere.
Hi, friends. Welcome to the Sales Enablement Podcast. I'm your host, Andy Paul. Now, that was George Brontain. George is the founder and CEO of Membrane, which is based out of Stockholm, Sweden, and is the author of a brand new book titled Stop Killing Deals. Now, you gotta love that title. It's short and to the point. And George is joining me today on Sales Enablement, episode 770, to talk about the sales behaviors, both subconscious and conscious, on the part of managers and individual sellers that, well, kill your ability to close deals. We're also going to dive into the behaviors that limit your ability to grow your sales organizations by attracting and retaining top sales talent, and as well the behaviors that impede your ability to develop the skills of your sales team, naturally all of which contribute to killing deals. And George will also share his prescriptions for overcoming the limiting beliefs or mindsets that he believes are the root of the problem. Now, before we get to George, I want to let you know that the whole team of people who work to produce this podcast, Sales Enablement with Andy Paul, are incredibly grateful for all of you who support us by listening to the show, telling your friends, sharing it on social media, and most importantly, subscribing to the show and giving us your feedback in the form of a rating and a review. So thank you. Okay, let's jump into it. George Brontain, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much, Andy. Nice to be back.
It's always a pleasure to speak with you. So you're joining us from Sweden, as always?
I am, from Stockholm, in my little man cave basement here.
But in Stockholm, you guys are not sort of restricted or sheltering in place. I mean, you're sort of some restrictions, but not a lot, right?
Yeah, it depends on who you ask. We've been working from home now, the entire company, for about 4 weeks. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we do the social distancing thing, but we haven't closed everything down like many other countries have.
Yeah. Well, obviously, topic of debate. Which is the right way to go? So
yeah, hard to tell. We'll see.
Yeah,
it's
funny.
It's
one of the few things probably the political conservatives in America agree with Sweden on is not going into total shutdown. But anyway, we won't get into that. So, So again, welcome back. Hey, just by way of background, so tell us how you got your start in sales.
Wow, that's always an interesting question. Where to start? I think I was selling already as a young kid on the block, calling my friends, and everyone knew I could fix the bikes in the area against mm-hmm. a small fee. But I guess professionally, my first sort of career job was selling loudspeakers in a store where they mm-hmm. had sort of an IKEA approach to loudspeakers where you could build your own.
Eesh.
Yeah, so that was cool. That was sort of my big passion in life as a teenager. So I thought that
you have
was
big
a very
speakers
cool
at home.
Job. Well, in my man cave, yes.
Okay, all right.
That's where they're allowed.
So from speakers and your first B2B job?
Yeah, I went to actually selling books. You know, the For Dummies series?
Yeah.
I was selling those here in Sweden. So I was traveling around the country, visiting computer stores and bookstores, and sold them the concept of dummies. So that was kind of fun. And after that, I started my first company, which was a portal for dentists, which was a complete stupid thing to do. No market research there. I just did it because I believed in the internet. This was maybe 92, 93, it was very early.
That's where were you 10 years old?
Yeah, exactly. I was 10 years old.
I see a picture of you.
Thanks. Maybe I need to update my profile picture. Yeah, so that wasn't a very good from a business standpoint, but of course I learned a lot. And after that, I founded a company called Upstream. And Upstream, in the beginning, we were doing websites for companies, mm-hmm. and that transformed mm-hmm. into software. We sold software, and the idea was basically to find sort of the golden nuggets out there that nobody knew about, and take those pieces of software to Scandinavia as the region we were representing, and then sell those through a network of resellers. And that led later to me starting my current baby, which is Membrane, where
That's
we
right.
build software for salespeople.
So if you look back throughout that sort of the arc of that career, who taught you how to sell? Who was your biggest influence?
Yeah, that's a good question. I guess I would have to maybe answer the customers. Trying to really, I mean, selling is from my perspective at least, is about helping someone to get to a better place. That they want to go to, or that they might not know yet that they want to go to, but you can help them get there.
Mm-hmm.
So I think selling, I mean, I've not gone through any kind of professional sales training in my career. So I had, of course, colleagues.
That's why you're so successful, by the way.
Yeah, I didn't go to any any trainings that taught me how to do a close. Yeah, that might be true. But so I learned from colleagues, and I learned from especially being very curious about the customers.
Mm-hmm.
What do they need? Why? How can I help? How can I be creative in solving their problems? So I think I've been studying people a lot. Just how people work, how people think, why people mm-hmm. make decisions. So I think that's also what intrigues me about this profession. It's
right.
so. It's so compelling to find out more about the mind and how people engage.
Right. So if you had to say, okay, here, this is my sales superpower. What's your sales superpower?
Yeah, I would probably say curiosity combined with business acumen.
Mm-hmm.
So to really try to understand the customer or the potential customer and then use my business acumen to come up with solutions on how to help them solve that in the mm-hmm. way that of course everyone benefits from.
Right. Yeah. I mean, knowing you as much as I do, I probably would have said similar thing. Good answer for you. So we're going to talk about your new book you've written called Stop Killing Deals, and very concise title. So who did you write the book for? Who's the intended audience?
Sales leaders and company leaders is the primary reader that mm-hmm. I wrote it for, because the whole idea about stop killing deals is that I think there is so much there's so many mistakes being made in selling that are a result of just making wrong assumptions about things.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of the pillar on which the book is written, and how and some of these should be pretty simple to fix, which is the reason for the title. Like, if you just stop doing some of the stupid things we all might be doing, and many more than others, that can take us very far. And I'm a bit irritated by the snake oil being peddled.
Mm-hmm.
In my space in particular, in the tech space, I mean, there's always a tool to fix your problem. But you can't have a tool for every problem.
Wait, you're saying membrane doesn't fix every problem?
Yeah, isn't that strange?
Yeah, wow.
It's weird. Yeah, so I'm kind of annoyed with that. And this whole AI and artificial intelligence, and everyone is using the latest buzzwords to sell something. Whereas I think we just need to get our head straight on what we're actually trying to do.
Well, I mean, one thing that's very clear in the book is, you talk about the sort of three primary self-limiting or limiting beliefs, as you called. And as you go through it, and you said, this book is written for managers and leaders and so on, is I've got sort of this beef, which is that I think that most sales issues that we're confronting today are really the fault of management. Mm-hmm. And yet that's not a very popular thing when you look online and you see what people write on LinkedIn and all these other places. It's all about, salespeople's limiting beliefs. But I think it's more important we talk about management's limiting beliefs.
Yeah, I do agree. I mean, it's always, isn't it always the leadership's fault? In the end, they're the ones coming up with the strategy. And the salespeople are executing that, but oftentimes there is no strategy, and you're just hoping that you find salespeople that somehow will do some magic tricks and sell whatever you've produced, and that's just not a good leadership strategy. So I agree. I guess that's a good thing, because I think if we could help frontline sales managers, I think there's a huge leverage there. They have too little resources. They're getting too little attention. They're bogged down with too much crap to do, mm-hmm. actually, and they're not being given the right type of training, and they're being screamed at a lot, and it's just not a fair game for sales managers. Which is also the fault of the leaders, the higher-ups, of course.
Sure. Well, I mean, you make the statement later in the book, and it wasn't about this issue per se, but I mean, obviously it is this issue. As you say, quote, "At the root of this problem is the fact that sales as a profession hasn't been taken very seriously for most of its history." And I would have added to that by management. Mm-hmm. Sales is not taken seriously the fact of selling is taken seriously. We need revenue, but sellers themselves and what they need and what sales managers need has not been taken seriously.
Yeah, I think that's of course a generalization, but that's what I'm seeing, and especially in companies led by engineers or finance people who haven't been selling themselves and haven't really been studying the field of sales. So that's why they're making all these assumptions, right? So I see a lot of toxic cultures in companies that are sort of product-led or engineer-led, and there's such a huge gap between those beliefs and what happens on the sales floor. So there's a lot of friction going on there.
Yeah, but I think the issue in terms of trying to we talk about enabling sellers, right? And so let's use that as sort of the catchphrase for improving performance is for me, as I, experience with decades doing this and sales management and leading sales teams, as well as doing this podcast and talking to hundreds upon hundreds of sales leaders, is that the problem for me is that management plays to the lowest common denominator. Right? As I sort of say, yeah, we're going to hire a team, and I know that 80% of them, probably aren't going to be good enough. And I accept that as just the fact. Mm-hmm. And so everything's sort of organized around that sort of organizing principle that, half my team or more just isn't going to be very good. And I'm going to take steps that just sort of reinforce that, because I'll give the good leads to the people I think are better. I'll give more resources to the people I think are better. And we just see this repeated time and time again. And managers don't really aren't equipped for the most part to say, how do I make somebody better? How do I manage somebody to an improved performance?
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. I think it's, I spoke to a founder of a tech company, and they were selling a tool with AI, and it was looking into the CRM and trying to find out if the deals in there in the pipeline were for real, or if there was a lot of just fluff in there. And, mm-hmm. and the interesting part of that story was that they finally had to put the company down. So they did not succeed. Mm-hmm. But looking back at it, and the reflections made were, we were selling to sales directors.
Mm-hmm.
And they loved the idea, but when they saw the product in action, everything became very transparent for them, but also for the leadership, right? So it became pretty apparent that they weren't really doing their job very well.
The emperor had no clothes.
Then they didn't want to buy it, right? So, and that's also very interesting. So it just becomes a very bad series of events if the leaders don't trust the or just assume that the sales director will know what to do, and the sales director does not have the resources, or maybe creates the right plan and the managers are not equipped correctly, or not hired directly, or not promoted correctly, etc., etc., and everyone tries to hide that they're doing something wrong. That's a very bad culture that gets created. I'm not saying that's the case everywhere, but
predominantly
it's quite often that's the case, and that's very sad. I mean, we should all be looking at like the Toyota way, like how do we improve everything? How do we ask five whys to come up with the root of the problem and fix that and improve continuously? Because nothing is. There's no right answer that solves everything. It's iteration. It's being agile, listening to customers. And I work a lot with sales process design. I mean, that's what the product then puts into and brings into life. And I see that a lot as well, that people want to create this perfect process. We're going to create this process. It's going to be fantastic. And they just over-engineer it to death. And just miss things like, we can't have one process. I mean, it's very different selling a highly transactional product to the mm-hmm. SMB than trying to sell a very enterprise
complex software.
And those are two different things and need two different processes, and maybe multiple processes within each of those segments, because we have different regions and cultures, etc. So there's so much complexity in selling, which I think also is why a lot of people just give up and say, well, you know, it's either you find the right people and it works, or you don't. And you just have to keep looking for those top performers.
Well, and that's a point you're making in the book, sort of a central point, which is part of the reason there's this management inattention to development of individuals is that, they spend their time thinking, I need to hire enough people that are already set to go, as opposed to I'm hiring potential.
Yeah.
And so they're looking for the people you said are salespeople that are born, not made, as one of the limiting beliefs you see organizations have. And I think that's essentially right, is people just playing the odds.
And then you have buyers. I mean, buyers are not, that's another assumption I talk about in the book, that we sort of think that buyers are irrational. And if we just prove them an ROI and demo our solution, they'll just say hallelujah and buy it. I mean, it's much more complex than that. So we need to wrap our head around that as well. And there are more stakeholders. Everyone is saying these things, but actually doing the right things to embrace the complexity is different from just understanding that it's complex.
Right. So I think that before we move on to the next topic, just to finish on this one, because again, the focus has to be is how do we enable people to achieve? How do we enable people to perform at higher levels? And I think you're talking about in your book, and I certainly agree, is that the limiting factor is really management. And I think one of the issues that we have to confront as a profession, if we really want to enable our sellers to achieve, is that we sort of need to blow up the way we manage sales right now. I mean, you look at, and I've, gotten on my soapbox many times about this on this program, but if you look at how professional sports teams have completely changed how they manage performance, these are performance, you know, performance organizations, right? The whole goal is just like sales. How do we get top professionals to perform to the top of their potential? Is they don't presume, yeah, they don't have a coaching staff of one, like we oftentimes have in sales, right? You might have a CRO, a VP, and then, you know, a couple, depending on how big your organization is, you might have, you know, a director, maybe a manager. But, you know, you get into sports, they've got these people that are specialists in performance improvement. You know, they've got data analysts, they've got, well, you know, I've given this example on the show before, is, you know, Liverpool is my soccer team, and I think they have three coaches in there, just on their first team squad, with the word performance in their title. Mm-hmm. You know, so we've become very specialized in those professions, much like we've done in the sales. Yeah, now we've got specialized sales roles, SDR, BDRs, AEs, account managers, you know, so on. But we fundamentally are managing sales the same way we did 120 years ago. We expect that CRO, expect that sales leader to know all of this, to be an expert on performance and mindset and motivation and all these things that the world has sort of said, well, no, you really got to hire specialists who are good at that.
Yeah, and you mentioned data analysts. That's an interesting topic as well, because that's something I see a lot of sales managers and sales directors not being very good at. But it's a very important piece of being able to manage and know who to coach about what and when, is to really know the numbers and understand how to read what is going on through the numbers. And that's a skill that I think a lot of sales leaders are lacking, and not just a skill. Maybe not just the skill, but actually the raw data, because the data in the systems are inaccurate oftentimes because of different factors, system not being used, the process just consisting of a few stages and no depth, no milestones. And there are a bunch of things that make this, just the KPIs coming out of these reports, the reporting systems are not really of any use to a coach. So you have to have, I mean, all that stuff needs to just be designed in a way that a coach can look at the numbers in a structured format that allows that person to see who needs to be helped with what and what. If is it a people problem? Is it a skills problem? Is it a strategy problem? Is it a product problem, competition? I mean, you have to know that by looking from at the data, and I see that that's a challenge for a lot of sales organizations.
Yeah, well, I think it's a challenge in society at large these days, is that we increasingly rely on data to communicate something. And we see it on the internet, you know, the press, you know, uses more graphics, fewer words. Yeah, I think we struggle with data literacy. Just because we have the data, to your point, doesn't mean we understand what it means. We don't know how to look at data and say, well, what's missing? Where's the context here, right? What's a missing variable that's having an impact on what these results are telling me? Mm-hmm. And I think that, again, this starts with management. I'm not faulting them, but is we need to be training managers, leaders, in how to look at data, how to understand data. And I don't hold myself out as an expert, but I'm reading as much as I can about it, because this is a problem. And we see it, you know, online, again, LinkedIn, where somebody will publish an article saying, you know, we've analyzed all these calls and this is what it means. And it doesn't mean that at all.
Oh yeah, no, I hate those.
It is just wrong, and we're misleading people. You can't take a brute force approach to that and say, yeah, with this broad brush, because, you know, anytime we see that type of stuff online, it's like, that's not the picture, right? Yeah. And yet people, because they're not accustomed to dealing with data yet, is they don't question it. And this happens on a more micro level with managers and the data they're getting from all their tools.
Yeah, and comparing data also, I think that a lot, if you look at a number, you want, and it's in your space, you of course, it's a natural thing to compare that with your numbers. The problem in selling is that there is no standard. So if someone says we have a win rate of X, you can't really know what that means unless you actually ask them, okay, how do you measure win rates? Where is it from the start of an opportunity until the time you win it or lose it? Or does it start when you make first contact? I mean, early prospecting. And people have these all mixed up, even within organizations.
Yes,
so,
absolutely.
So that makes it really, really hard also to start comparing, and especially those kind of marketing stats that are thrown around. Like if you ask the customer X within the first 3.3 minutes and 12 seconds, you'll get Y. It's like, come on. That's what I mean with selling, peddling snake oil. That's just annoying to me.
Oh yeah, no, I'm the first one to get annoyed at that. Yeah, because again, we're doing a disservice to people that want easy answers, and we're not in a business where there's really a lot of easy answers to be had.
Not if you're in a complex B2B sale. I mean, if you're in Amazon and you're in e-commerce, I'm sure you can go really, really deep on algorithms and everything they're doing to transactionalize sales and squeeze out more numbers by changing prices with a tenth of a dollar or whatever it may be. But in a complex B2B sales, multiple months of sales cycles, multiple people involved, I mean, that just goes away. I mean, it's a whole different ballgame.
Yeah. Well, moving on. I mean, another thing you'd write about is, which is always sort of one of my topics I enjoy talking about, is the damage done by managers for creating what you called a needlessly stressful work environment. So tell us what you meant about that.
Yeah, there are many, many aspects of that. But I think there is this belief that if we just do more, we'll improve performance. So I see a lot of focus on do more, send more emails, do more phone calls, and we'll all close better, or get more people to the proof of concept and we'll sell more. And the problem with that kind of activity-led, efficiency-focused approach is that unless you're doing the right things, it doesn't help that you just do more of it.
Well, I mean, at some point, it sort of does. I mean, you're just turning sales into a game of chance at that point.
Yeah,
which is what a lot of companies have done these days. It's just, I know if I put enough crap into the top of the funnel, enough nuggets will fall out the bottom.
And I think also what's important to say in that on that topic is if you're a startup you're from Silicon Valley, you have $10 million in the bank. You can sell the product to anyone who's alive, any company. I mean, maybe it makes sense for you to spray and pray like crazy for the first 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't matter if you upset a few people along the way. So maybe that's an okay tactic, although I kind of dislike it anyway. But that can get you to the next level. Whereas if you're a manufacturing company and you have 432 potential clients worldwide, that would be an awful tactic to take.
And I'm familiar with that. I mean, I spent a good chunk of time selling in the satellite industry. For my product, I had roughly 200 customers worldwide. Potential.
Yeah.
My total addressable market.
Yeah. And you don't want to mess those relationships up by spamming people. So, I think you have to know what's right for the type of selling environment you're in and not listen to the advice of companies and leaders and product pushers that are active in a completely different type of sales environment.
But I think this idea of this, what you call the needlessly stressful work environment is caused by managers who make this assumption that people basically know how to perform.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also fear-based as well, right? Because oftentimes the managers are dealing with their own sets of insecurities because they haven't been trained, right? So to your point earlier, so all they know is perhaps, well, let's do more of something. But they don't necessarily have the resources to say, well, how do we do this before you can do more, you got to learn how to do better. And then once you learn how to do better, you can do more better. But
yeah, exactly. No, I absolutely agree. And I think the formula that I've learned for productivity is effectiveness times efficiency. So if you're being effective and you're doing all the right things, then of course, you'll improve performance if you also increase efficiency. Mm-hmm. But if you're multiplying by zero or 0.1, you can run very fast without actually getting anywhere because you're running in circles.
Yeah.
Yeah. But stressful environment, I think, also is managers. We were talking about those. I think managers are often in a very stressful position because they're pulled Absolutely. In different directions and they're asked to do different reports. And they're not. There's no real understanding about what their work should be about from their managers, and maybe sometimes not even they might not even know themselves what they ought to be doing because they haven't been managers in the past, and they were promoted because they were a good salesperson. I'm sure you've talked about this many times on the show. So they become kind of reactive. But they're being directed by people who don't know what they really should be doing and spending their time on. So it's a very, it's a hard and tough job to be a manager.
Oh, yeah, no, it's thankless in many environments. So how do we turn that, right? Because to turn anything around, to make any sort of substantial changes or substantive changes, there's going to be some pain involved, and companies have to be willing to accept some pain to change how we manage sales.
Yeah, and I think people don't change unless they have to, unfortunately, most of the times. So people come to a point in time where their margins are eroding and their competitors are eating their lunch. That's when it becomes a burning platform and they have to do something, unfortunately. That's what we're seeing.
Well, but we're, if you look at the industry reports, we're sort of in this downward trend, if not spiral, in terms of sales performance, CSO Insights reports, other reports out there. So, I mean, it's not that there's necessarily rigorous studies, but, data points saying, we're in this golden age where we've got all this great sales technology to invest in and apply to the process, and yet our performance is sinking. So to me, it seems like there is a sense of urgency about it.
But I don't know if it is, because as you mentioned previously, they've just sort of accepted the fact that, 80% of my salespeople will not perform. I have to go recruit the 20% that can perform, and I'll just have this constant churn and rotation of people, and somehow that's become the norm. So unfortunately, I see a lot of leaders out there who are not striving for excellence. They've sort of gotten into this mode that this is the way it is. So I guess they need just to be awakened, and usually they are by competitors who get it and start running very fast, and they're being outcompeted. And that's when they sort of wake up to, oh, crap, there's a better way to do it. What are we going to do? Who can we imitate? I'm being a bit harsh, but I think that's how human beings usually work. We love the status quo. We hate change for the most part. And we just change when we really have to. And this whole situation we're in now is telling. Corona and COVID-19 is a really scary virus. And we see some causes that increase our sort of risk factors to it, and we should be doing some stuff to reduce that. But we still don't. So even in the face of death, we sometimes just prefer the status quo. So people have a very hard time changing. That's just the way it is, unfortunately. But those who have ambition, those are the front runners, and they. I think from my perspective, selling just has to become more of a profession. We have to realize that selling is a super interesting profession. We're working with people. We're helping. We're not just trying to. We have to get away from this perception that selling is something that we do onto people. That we try to just sell stuff to make money. That's not what professional selling is all. Is about. So there's a perception thing that we need to work on. But then just structure sales and stop just chasing these shortcuts for everything. I think we have to look at it as building a house. You have to sort of, you can't start by building the roof. You have to build the foundation and the walls, and then you can build the roof. But a lot of people just try to take shortcuts and say, oh, if we just buy this latest, coolest tool, or we send the salespeople to this new, really hot methodology that came out, that's going to solve everything. So no, it's not going to solve everything. Just, do you have a strategy? Do you have a process? Do you have the right skills? Are you coaching? Are you coaching even more and more and more? Do you understand the data? Do you know the data? Do you know your KPIs? I mean, all these basic things, it should seem like, are not in place.
Yeah. Well, I think, again, it gets sort of back to what we were talking about earlier, is there's all this focus in this profession on how do we enable sellers to perform. And the biggest obstacle to it is sitting right there in plain view, and I contend, management, that hasn't, the way we manage sales has not fundamentally changed in, I said, a century. And until we're willing to tackle that, until we're willing to take it seriously enough, to your point in your book that leaders just don't take sales seriously enough. I mean, again, they take revenue seriously, but you know, we've structured sales in such a way that by and large, in most companies, it's just like, yeah, this is sort of a necessary evil. We'll do it and we're going to feed it just enough to sort of get what we want out of it. But we're just sort of muddling along from year to year to year.
And the good thing about that is I think there are some simple mistakes that keep on being made in selling that we could fix easily.
Okay. Give us an example.
Yeah. So in my previous company, the main problem was that we did not engage all the right stakeholders. And I would argue that is the number one problem in a complex sale. We primarily talk to a few stakeholders that engage with us, I mean, reactively, I mean, we look at all the inbound and that whole spiel, and we don't find out how they will have to make a decision, how their organization works, et cetera, et cetera. We just try to push the product in there. It's not going to work. So just by identifying who need to be involved to make a decision about this, why would they even buy something at all? And how does that compare to all the other stuff? Because that's another problem, I think, that we make in selling. We're so concerned about the competitors to our product. But usually we don't lose because they buy another product, but it's because they prioritize another project. Or they deprioritize the project that you could be helping them with. But I think a lot of times we don't look at status quo as the main competitor, whereas it might actually be. Instead, we look at the competition to our product as the main competitor, which it might not be. So just going back to the simple product, I'm making this complex now, but knowing who needs to be involved if we can nail that, if we could just focus on that for a year, I'm certain that's going to really move the needle for most sales teams.
Well, I think I would put a fine tune on that, which is identify the stakeholders who are going to do what, right? I don't think, this is, I think, a point where we miss increasingly in sales is that, and you talked about, because we're there, sellers going and push the product. Well, they're pushing the product when the customer hasn't really decided, A, what their problem is, and B, how they want to solve it.
Exactly.
So they haven't defined the solution. So as sellers, you should be focused on identifying the stakeholders who are responsible for defining how they're going to solve, ultimately, how they're going to solve the problem.
Yeah, exactly.
Focus your effort there, because that's a process all decision makers have to go through, right? They have to identify the problem, come up with solutions they can choose from, options they can choose from, and choose one of the options that they want to proceed with. Who they choose as a vendor to help them implement that option, that's the last thing that happens. Yet that seems to be where most people are focused on a sales standpoint. And we've got to, I said, to your point earlier about that's when you do that, when you focus on that endpoint, that's selling to someone as opposed to working collaboratively with them to help them solve their problem.
Yeah. You phrased that much better than I did, but I am in complete agreement with you on that. Yeah, because they're making they're going to make a decision about improving something. And if you're going to be involved or not, that's going to be a result of if they define the problem or how they define the problem in the first place.
Well, I mean, you touch on this a little bit in the book when you talk about checklists, and I love the fact you embrace Atul Gawande and the Checklist Manifesto. I think every salesperson, every sales manager, every sales leader should be reading that book if they haven't already. But one of the things that's sort of interesting, though, is I love the idea of checklists, but I think we also have to caution against becoming too prescriptive in our sales process to this point, because we want to... We've got these, you know, sort of, I think, consider inflexible sales processes that many companies put together, and they don't align with the buying experience of the buyer and how they're going through their process. And I think that becomes one of our big challenges, and sort of to this discussion we just had about helping define what their solution should be and who those stakeholders are who are involved in that. That's not a linear process at all. You know, that's not a stage-based process. That requires a lot of flexibility. And so how do we reconcile that, you know, having a process with a customer that really has no process?
Yeah, it's true. And I think it's difficult to, from now I'm in my head, the technology is spinning, right? I'm seeing the screens and it's hard to have a non-linear workflow. But I think the way we've seen customers approach it is looking at more of a milestone approach, and that a milestone that you complete can also be uncompleted. I mean, sometimes you have to go back
because you
didn't have all the stakeholders to really get to that point. You had one person that made it got to that point,
or maybe you had them all, but somebody said, "Well, hey, we didn't think about this."
Yeah,
right. And then it's like, oh shit, we gotta go think about that. Yeah,
that's right. We can do this on our own. Yeah. So of course, yeah, I agree. So you have to design the process with the buyer in mind, and that's not super simple either, because all buyers are not the same. But I think we have to sort of find the common denominators on a milestone basis, and there are different approaches. I mean, Gartner is talking about their works to be done, and there's some methodologies around that, so you can define that. Have we helped them do this part of their decision-making journey? Right. Yes. Or what steps do we need to take there? And we're building some cool stuff where we're actually dynamically changing the process based on strengths and weaknesses of each individual salesperson.
No, I like
because
that.
Yeah, because a very senior, experienced person who knows the customers inside out, the industry, and the products, he might not need the same kind of enablement that a new person that we're just onboarding would need. So I also like the way that we need to make these processes much more dynamic and agile and change based on who you are as a salesperson, but also who's the customer, what's the industry. All these things need to come together in a nice way.
Yeah. All very interesting. Well, George, we're sort of run out of time here, but thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Well, so tell folks how they can find out more about Membrane and your book.
Yeah, so I'm active on LinkedIn, so find me there, George Bronten, connect with me, and membrane.com if you want to learn more about that. And the book has a cool URL, it's stop.killing.deals.
Very emphatic, I like that.
Yeah, nice. Thanks, Andy.
Thanks a lot. Okay, friends, that's it for this episode. First of all, I want to thank you for taking the time to listen. I'm so grateful for your support of this program. I also want to thank George Brontain for sharing his story with us today. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to this podcast, Sales Enablement with Andy Paul, on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to this show. And if you could also leave us a rating or review and let us know how we're doing, we'd appreciate it. You can do all that on your phone in less than a minute as soon as this podcast is over. So thank you for your help. And thank you so much for investing your time to join me today. Until next time, I'm your host, Andy Paul. Good selling, everyone.
Hey, sales strategists. At Revenue.io, we're not just imagining the future of sales. We're building it. We offer the world's most complete platform for revenue teams, and we're featured in the most recent Forrester Waves for both sales engagement and conversation intelligence. With Revenue.io, you can slash call prep time to seconds, guide your reps in real time to have more successful conversations, and after calls, we generate ready-to-send recap emails so sellers can keep deals soaring toward the finish line at light speed. See the future of sales now at Revenue.io.